Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, and I am the producer of the show, and we are thrilled to have you here with us today. Hey, we have one of our favorites with us today, a fellow Nashvillian, Audrey Assad. Audrey is the iconic artist. She is one of those artists who is held in high regard here in the artistic community of Nashville. She's a multiple Dove Award nominee, and she is one of those artists who is always authentically putting it out there. So she's also an author, and she has recently launched a one-to-one and group coaching practice. So a lot of exciting things today. We talk about numbers. We talk about wings. We talk about her one-to-one subtype. We talk about the importance of spiritual community. We cover a lot of ground today, so you're going to enjoy this conversation. So we're really glad that you're here. Hey, that's it for me, Anthony Skinner. And now, without any further ado, here is the host of our show, Ian Cron.
Audrey Assad, one-to-one nine, singer-songwriter, author of a great upcoming book, Doubt Becomes Wonder, coach, and extraordinary human being. We're so glad you're on Typology today.
Thank you for having me, Ian. Good to see you.
We were just talking about your performance at the Ryman.
You're stealing my thunder here.
Oh, am I? Well, you bring it up. I just wanted to let her know we were talking about it beforehand.
Oh, yeah, we... I remember I saw you. I don't know if it was Token Show or
whatever. It would have been. Yeah, it would have been.
And
that's the only way they let me in the Ryman. Only way I get in there.
Well, you could buy a ticket.
Right. Oh, through the backstage door. That's the only way I get in.
Right.
Token Show. So.
Well, we you played Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Oh, gosh.
And I remember thinking to myself, you got about two bars in, and of course I knew right away what it was. And I thought to myself, oh, Audrey. Oh, Audrey. Because it's one of those iconic songs that you gotta have a lot of courage to play that song.
I think you have to have a lot of balls to play that song.
Yeah, exactly. I was
it's my eight wing is like, I got this. My nine wing is like, are you sure? You know, but I'm not my nine wing, my main type, but I'm glad. I hope you liked it. It is a courageous move.
Well, I said a little prayer for you.
Thank you.
And then, I even turned to my wife, Ann, and I was like, oh boy, taking on a song that most people would say was, you know, beyond their weight class. And you got about half a verse into it. And I said, damn, she's got it.
She's got this.
And wow, I remember, and then I relaxed. Honored. I relaxed back into the pew. And I was
I love that. Oh.
Yeah.
I love that you took it that seriously, because I take that song that seriously. I played that a few times at home and thought, like, do I do this? Because I did it on a whole tour every night with Sarah Groves 1 year. And I was like, it's a move, you know, because people know it so well. It's in the cultural consciousness to such a deep level that, yeah, it's like, I'm glad that you took it that seriously. It matters a lot to me. So,
well, next time I expect you to do Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Okay.
That is equally, dangerous territory, you know, because it was done right the first time, you know.
And it was done right the first time.
Yeah. So good on you for courage and amazing execution on it.
Thank you so much. Wow.
So every person is a unique expression of their type. You are a sexual nine. You have an eight wing. Mm-hmm. And I want to know how you would describe your experience of being a nine.
Okay. Well, it's evolved a fair amount, as it does, I'm sure, for most people, all people. But I think the hallmark of my experience as a nine is that I attend to really desire harmony and holding all things in tension and unity at once. And so that is probably the hallmark of my whole life. And I find that in my spiritual work and in my spiritual evolution, in my political activism, in my romantic relationships and friendships, I tend to be, I have a lot of mutable energy in my astrological chart, which can mean just a lot of both and type energy. Both and is kind of my life's theme, I would say. And so that's the main hallmark of my nine experience is both and energy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which of course that, non-dualistic thinking is incredibly wonderful. It's a great gift. Nines have no problem with paradox.
Nope.
In fact, paradox.
I love it. It feeds me.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like paradox is something to swim in, you know?
Yeah.
You know, whereas ones, eights tend to be, you know, more black and white thinkers, more things are either black and white, right or wrong, you know, et cetera. And of course, actually, though they don't believe it, that too can be a gift, right? Because
absolutely,
for the nine, sometimes they never land.
Right.
Right.
My literary agent told me my whole brand is change. I'm always just like, where's my next like eddy in the river? But I don't land very often or very long on anything. My eight wing sort of grounds me into some more like fixed points of reference, but which I'm grateful for. I'm so grateful that nines are winged by eight and one because it is such a helpful balance to my melty, you know, I want to merge with everyone and everything sometimes. And that is a gift, but I need grounding. I need salt. I need rocks and grass and things that are, you know, like physical and real. And
so. Yeah, because some things are right or wrong. You know what I mean? Like,
sure. Like
both and doesn't work with racism.
Right.
Both and doesn't work with
right.
a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And right. so, you know, to have
right.
the ability to see all perspectives sometimes totally. Doesn't really.
Totally. Work. I mean, you know what I think the gift of it is not about ideas, but about people. That I can both hold that an idea is flawed or damaging or what have you, and be able to contextualize the human being holding the idea as a person with a very fragmented psyche like everyone else, and sort of seeking to understand the particular ways in which they arrived at these conclusions. Like right. that's where that energy comes in a healed way for me. Now, when I'm in like when I've been in a less healed or whole state or moment to moment, when I'm fluctuating up and down the sort of normal ladder of health that goes throughout our day or function or whatever, you know, I can tend to be a people pleaser or like a bypasser in those ways. And so it is something to look out for, operating in it as a gift and not an escape.
Yeah. And so you just used a very important word, bypasser, or we talk often, though not on the show. So that's why I want to ask you what you mean by that, because spiritual bypassing is a very important idea in the spiritual life.
Right.
Can you just tell people what you mean by being a bypasser?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've seen it crop up a lot for me in both my kind of Christian experience, which is the context from which I've arrived at adulthood. And then my kind of foray into what I guess some people would call New Age spirituality, for lack of a better term, but kind of like engaging with these more, all this work on like the ego and the self and the all this kind of stuff, Jung, Ram Dass, all of the above. In both worlds and in all worlds, there's a potential that we can kind of sometimes manifest to go like, well, I practice acceptance of all that is. And in doing that, I ignore or dismiss or bypass the very real social ills that I see, because I just accept that they're here. And I accept that you believe what you believe. And so you get to be you and I get to be me. And you know, that's one form. And that's kind of in the New Age camp. It tends to be a little bit more easy and tempting to accept all, like the way Carl Jung talks about accept all, reject none. But the thing is, when you practice real acceptance of what is here, it also means the conflict and the divisions and the fragmented psyche and the things that are, you know, like, I'm thinking of a friend of mine who's an Enneagram 8, and on Twitter, she is just like balls to the wall all the time about social justice. And some people really find that irritating, but I'm sort of like, we need people like that. Like, we need people who aren't just sitting around like accepting that things are wrong. We need people who will storm the gates. Like, that's part of all. That's part of accepting all. And in my Christian experience, it would be more like, well, God has a plan. God has a reason for what you're going through. So it's another form of the same acceptance. Well, something must be, there must be some reason why you lost your child. Like, lean on the fact that God's understanding is higher than yours and bypass the grief and the confusion and the anger that you're feeling, because those things are bad feelings. You know, that's another form of spiritual bypassing that masquerades itself as acceptance.
Yes. Yes. You know, I oftentimes will say, when I meet someone who's, what I would call theologically rigid, or right. That they are spiritually bypassing doing their own shadow work.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, you have managed to take your spirituality and fit it into a particular construct that, you know, assuages your anxiety about the unpredictability of the world and the, you know, about the mystery in just inherent in all faiths, you know, and it's like, well, you know, you're bypassing your anxiety and living with it, right? And I think for every single type on the Enneagram, there is a particular kind of spiritual bypassing that they might have a tendency to gravitate toward. And so maybe we'll do a show on that sometime in the future, like how to avoid spiritual bypassing for each type.
For the different numbers. I think that's a great idea.
Well, that's great. So I want to talk just for a minute about sexual nines, because we here at Typology really focus on subtypes. A lot of teachers don't, and I think it's a big mistake. There really are 27 types. It's good to start with nine. If you go further on the journey, you really can't avoid the 27 subtype, you know, the whole subtype world. As I understand it, one-to-one nines are kind of the ninest of the nines.
Resonates.
and so when you go to a workshop on the Enneagram or you listen to a podcast and someone describes a one-to-one nine, it really just sounds like the nine you hear about in books and everywhere else versus the social and self-pres nines, which present very differently. Differently. And so let's just talk for a minute for people who are new to subtypes about the unique kind of hue of the sexual nine. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually relatively new to the subtype conversation as well. It was actually about, I want to say, 5 months ago that I had that kind of finally landing on what I felt. I mean, it took me years, which is probably pretty nine of me. I was like, I see myself in all these things. I feel like I am this way sometimes, and I'm this way other times. And it really wasn't until I actually encountered a pretty brash eight, that I was a new person in my life. And he said, I'm going to censor the profanity. But he said, this is how you know if you're a sexual type. He said, sexual nines walk into a room and they immediately know how much every person in that room wants to F them. And he said, but it isn't really about sex. It's about really being able to walk into a room and kind of sense the energy and decide, I know exactly who and with what I want to be interacting here, and then zoom in and really go deep with that person. That's one example maybe of how it might manifest. And I am absolutely that person in a lot of ways, you know, going to a party or a wedding and like looking for my people. And I've even used dating apps that way. I've been on dating apps and I've been like, who are like my people? The energies that I know I can resonate with, I can sense who they are. And even if we wouldn't connect romantically, I like know you would be my friend. I know. And I've never been wrong. Not once. Wow. It's so interesting. So I think I have a certain, that's for me how it manifests the most, is this ability to read a person's spiritual energy and know how I would interact with it and whether or not I'd like to. That's kind of a way that I feel like I experience that.
Yeah, and you're really describing the dominant instinct there of the nine, which is when if they walk into a room, as you just to use your example, the big fear they have would be their attention goes toward desirability. Am I desirable?
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
And I think the sexual nine is the least assertive of all the nines. Okay.
That's interesting because I will say that is not how I present socially, but I think that could be my eight wing. Mm-hmm. But because I tend to be actually pretty confident and maybe not assertive though. I guess maybe I'm not really assertive when I think about it and say it out loud. I'm like, I'm a deeply confident person, but I do tend to like let other people take the lead because I'm like, right. I'm cool. I don't need to do that.
Right.
But I can. I know I can, and sometimes I pick my moment and I'm like in there.
Right.
But
to use a phrase I often use, maybe for you, as opposed to a 3, 7, or 8, to take the lead requires that you burn more calories.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Whereas an 8 actually gets calories from a 3 does, a 7 does, you know. I'm a 4, I'm a withdrawing type, and so like a 5 and a 9, 4s, 5, and 9s. And so I can lead, but I'm very happy not to. I mean, I have a pretty strong 3 wing, which you know, I can lean into at the moment, but you know, it's not my.
That makes so much sense. And something I really like about myself is that I love seeing other people win. I get so much actual satisfaction out of watching someone operating in their gift. And I do have my own just jealousies and insecurities as a person because I'm human. But one thing I don't really wrestle with is watching someone else and be like, I wish I was up there right now. I'm like, I love watching someone thriving and succeeding. And my jealousies really are around the desirability issue. Seeing success.
Right. So when you see others who are appear to be more desirable than you, it would, you know, elicit those kinds of feelings. Like sexual types tend to be definitely more jealous than the other two subtypes.
That's interesting.
But particularly when it comes to a romantic partner or an intimate friend, for example, if maybe as a little kid you felt this way, but if you had said to a friend as a little kid, hey, let's play today. And then you get to their house and there's another kid there.
Interesting.
Who you might even like, right? But you wanted that special time with your friend, just the two of you. And
that's so interesting. I've never really characterized that as jealousy, but I see how it is. Huh.
You're jealous of the time, right? Or
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And so even with a partner might say, you might feel like a partner is spending too much time at work or too much time volunteering, and it's really taking away from time in the relationship. And you could even become jealous of the work they're doing.
You know, what's interesting is I'm sitting with my reaction to that. And I actually do, it resonates a lot with me 5 years ago. There are ways in which I think through shadow work, I've actually begun to transform and transmute that in myself. Because I will say that 5 years ago, I think that was like hyper true of me. And now I've kind of come to a spot where I'm starting to experience more change in that area.
Yes.
And but that would definitely be where I started. Yeah.
And we're going to circle back to Carl Jung because I know that Jung has become a really important influence in your life. But just to throw it into his language, it sounds like you have experienced a great deal of individuation in the last few years. And so
I have.
That would explain, how the nine who typically merges, and for a sexual nine, it would be merges with another individual.
Right.
Versus a social nine who will merge with the agenda of the group.
Okay.
Versus another person.
right? So because the sexual nine tends to merge in order to glean a sense of identity from the other.
Yes.
Now I'm describing an unevolved nine here. So I'm not necessarily describing you.
Yeah. But my shadow still exists, you know. So
totally
carry them inside me. Yeah. Yep.
And so they have trouble when they're not very conscious, right? They tend to, how do I want to say this? They become blurry. Mm-hmm. They start to blur the line between where they end and where the other begins. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's this.
That's so funny.
Yeah. For those of you who are watching, it's more this. Mm-hmm. And then as you get healthy, it becomes this.
Mm-hmm. Where did you just go when you?
Oh, I'm just recalling a song I wrote in 2008. And the first line of it was, where do I begin? Where do I end? And where do you begin? Mm. We're tangled up together. Our limbs are intertwined. It goes on this whole illustration about like two trees sort of twining together. And that for me was what it felt like to love someone then. Mm. Just like two root systems completely intertangling. Mm-hmm. Now I'm like, oh, that's entanglement.
Exactly. But that's consciousness coming into play, right? Like for Jung, and again, I don't want to get too academic with folks, but this is a pretty easy concept that I think everyone would get, which is, sorry for repeating myself, Anthony, it's like how to make the unconscious conscious. When you know, now you have made and stopped idealizing or making a virtue of enmeshment. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, you know, the great paradox is, and Nines will love this, is that the more you become yourself separate from others, the greater the probability that you will actually come into real relationship.
Yep.
Which is why
I'm experiencing that.
I was just that's just why the Enneagram is such a helpful tool, because what you did pursue, you know, as a goal, you realize now is your shadow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I thank it. I thank it and I accept it, because there's no other place to begin than the beginning. And the void is important. And it's the birthplace of all things. So.
Yes. And I was going to say, we all do that. I mean, we all need these tools to help us, because we don't even know we're in our shadow. It's like Jung says, right? He who looks inside awakes.
Yeah. Oh, I love him. I wish he were here. He is here in our unconscious right now.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to use a phrase that some people understand, but I don't want it to be understood in this context. You know, people have probably, many people have read, though I haven't, the five love languages, right? And so let's talk about, I think there are nine love languages.
Okay.
Right. And I'm just curious if you had to, in brief, talk about what is the love language for you as a sexual nine? What is it? Or a 1-to-1-9. Sorry. That's the different term.
Well, that's interesting, because I certainly have my own thoughts and feelings about that whole idea. Because I believe that every human's first and primary love language is touch, whether or not they feel that way. Mm. I could be wrong, but based on my studies of attachment theory and kind of the way that a body and a person becomes mirrored and their identity as a self develops, a huge part of that is being touched in appropriate, safe ways. And a lot of the fragmentation around relationships to touch develops really early, but I don't think it means that it's not a primary love language for all people. But that's the way I see that. But putting that aside for a second, my primary love language is physical touch. My second would probably be words of affirmation. I tend to be very effusive with people I love, physically and verbally. Very, maybe too much.
Like a two. My wife is a nine. My daughter's a nine. And both of them are very tactile people. Some teachers would disagree with me. I think part of that is that you're in the body triad. And so, you know, I think, you know, when I meet self-pres fives, that is not a first line, you know, it's
right.
they got to work on
it. I know a couple of those. Yeah.
You know, I know some ones who really have to work on it. Twos are very tactile. I know some threes who would be a little bit more, you know, and of course, trauma has a lot to do, right? You know, there are
A lot to do with personality in general.
It does. And this is where the Enneagram does help, because I know when I'm with a five, particularly one that hasn't done any work, and this has happened to me in corporate settings and other places where I just know I got to stand back another foot than I do away from them than I do with a two. You know, twos want to hug you out the gate, you know. Sometimes in a way that's uncomfortable for me, you know, because it can feel like engulfment.
Yeah, I hear that.
You know, which is, you know, or what James Hollis would call overwhelmment. I can kind of go, oh, I feel like you're getting a little histrionic and overwhelming for me.
Totally. And one of the great things about, I think, my subtype, one of the things I like about it is that I do actually try to read the room or the person. My instinct is to be like, how are you? Hand on the shoulder. I would touch people. I mean, like, not in inappropriate ways, but I'm like, if you let me and you feel good about it, like, I will snuggle my friends. I'm like, I love cuddling people. I'm just like so tactile, but I do not force that on anyone, because I can read if that's like something someone wants. And I ask, like, if I don't know them, I'm like, can I put a hand on your shoulder?
Yes.
I'm feeling a desire to put a hand on your shoulder while you're talking about this very hard thing. Can I do that? And if it's okay, if not, but like, it is my instinct for sure.
And you know, I've never met a person who was offended when I said to them, do you mind if I hug you? You know,
totally.
It's like when someone says to me, you know, I've never been offended when a younger person or anyone has said to me, you know, called me sir. You know what I mean? It's sort of like that never offended me, you know, and it's never. I don't know anyone who's, and I've had people say to me, I'm not a touching type of person.
Yeah. And I love, like, when someone can do that. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and I think when you know the Enneagram, you start to learn how to ask questions like that.
Good, yeah.
I love that.
Anthony, what if I told you you could get high quality, organic, and non-GMO groceries delivered to your door for a lot less than you're paying now and help out families in need?
No. Really?
Let me tell you, that's what I'm doing since I discovered Thrive Market. As a proud Thrive Market member, I get the products I love, and my paid membership provides a free membership for one low-income family.
Oh, now I like this.
Right? And let me tell you this.
Okay.
I've ordered off their website, which, by the way, is very user-friendly. It's not at all like, you know, like one of those websites where you feel like you just fell into some kind of terrible labyrinth. They have the best selection of high quality, healthy, and sustainable products online. A couple of things I love. They have Jackson's Honest Sweet Potato Chips. Have you ever jammed on those before?
I have not.
Well, you're welcome.
All right.
Jackson's Honest Sweet Potato Chips I got at Thrive Market. And
yes,
I used to be a Goline cereal guy. Remember that?
I know this, yes.
And that's because I'm so healthy. But now I eat organic coconut flakes cereal from Thrive Market.
Ooh, I can't wait to try that.
It is changing my whole life. As a special offer for Typology listeners, join Thrive Market today to get 25% off your first order and an exclusive free gift. The only way to get this offer is by going to thrivemarket.com/typology. That's T-H-R-I-V-E market.com/typology to get the exclusive offer of 25% off your first order and
yes,
a free gift.
Nice.
You can't get this offer anywhere else. Go to thrivemarket.com/typology.
All right, so I want to talk about spiritual crisis and deconstruction, and I want to talk. I want to talk about it through the lens of the Enneagram, not just, you know, in general, but about. I know that you've been on a journey of spiritual deconstruction. You come out of a
I think if I had said to you 5 years ago how you would self-identify spiritually, you'd have said a Catholic Christian, right?
Yeah.
In a serious one, a serious one, right? And and I'm just wondering, I know you've been on this path. Tell me about it. And again, through the through the lens of a nine.
Okay. So I came from, before Catholicism, I came from a very, very, very fundamentalist evangelical background. And in that world, I struggled because it was very rigid, hyper rigid. And I had a very real piece of myself that really, really obviously wanted to belong, wanted to escape hell, wanted to continue to have a community life. And we were a shunning community. We were very sort of binary and insulated from the world. We didn't vote. We didn't marry outside. We didn't get into business with people outside our denomination. It was like 60 people at our church. We lived our whole lives almost entirely together outside of, you know, the work and school day. And so, but I struggled because I'm a nine. So I would hear these things and things people would say about whatever it would be, like homosexuality or about politics or, and I'd go like, I can't, this is, I'm so pulled like in different directions by my desire to merge and belong and feel accepted and approved of and desired. And I cannot understand how you can draw these lines. And so the perfect way, I feel like a good illustration of this is when I was 8 or 9 years old, Bill Clinton was elected president. And I vividly remember the election because I, my, you know, there was Rush Limbaugh playing in my house talking about the end times. And like, everybody was like, Bill Clinton is the Antichrist, because we're always looking for that outside instead of in. And I was so scared of all of that. I had so much stress running through my body. But in my school election, I voted for him both times that they did a poll. And I dealt with so much shame and stress about what I was hearing was going on and my own instincts toward a different way of thinking, that when the election night rolled around, I remember that I had cold sores rimming my whole mouth. Like I probably had 12 of them from stress, from the stress of feeling pulled in two directions and not knowing how to like process my instincts versus the group versus the what the standard for belonging and acceptance was. And so my deconstruction started in earnest in the spring of 2015. And I remember I wrote an email to a friend who is an agnostic, which is kind of in between agnostic and atheist, for lack of a better, easier way to describe it. Former Christian, music industry professional. And I wrote him an email and I was like, I don't know what to do. I've allowed myself to ask all the questions that I had. And my biggest question started as, what if nobody's coming? What if nobody's coming? And I was like, I don't think anyone is coming. I think everything that's coming is already here or something. Like I was starting to really get into touch with like the idea of the unconscious collective and sort of like, and it appealed to me and like terrified the shit out of me, because I was like, well, if that's it, like if everything my life has been built on is kind of a projection of a wounded collective psyche, basically, I've got to redo everything. Like, it sounds exhausting. I just remember being like, I can't, I'm tired. I'm a new mom. Like what? But I couldn't let it alone. You know, it just was happening. And so I will say it was fast. I was pretty tormented for about a year, but I was like, nope, burn it all down. Like we're done. And, but then I was faced with the very difficult piece of having a public life as a person who was a very public Christian at the time, a Catholic. I guess technically I'm still Catholic. I was baptized Catholic. And so now I've been living in this weird liminal space of like, how do I be forthcoming about this evolution while still being the both and person that I am? Because I don't want to burn bridges. I want to invite people into wholeness in any way I can, which sometimes requires burning down structures, but I don't want to burn down bridges. I want to burn structures down. And so my eight wing is like, yes, take the torch to the thing. My nine wing is like, keep the bridges open, you know, so people can come across. And so I'm kind of in that stage now where I'm just like reckoning with the shift. And I've been a lot more forthcoming on my socials and such about the evolution I've been going through. And yeah, it was a tough thing to be a both and person in a fundamentalist background. Mm. Very, very tormenting. I experienced a lot of stress from that.
And you know, I'm glad you mentioned 9 with 8 because people say to me sometimes, I think subtypes are more important than wings. However, and I actually know spiritual directors and Enneagram teachers who will ignore wings altogether.
Okay.
Because yeah, they would say, I don't know. It's interesting, but I'm not really into it. The reason I like them is because they explain so many of the contradictions within a type. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a 4 with a 3 wing would be a good example. A 9 with an 8 wing would be a good example. So, you know, there's more contradictions in a 9 with an 8 wing than a 9 with a 1 wing.
I've heard that.
Right.
I've heard I'm a rare sort.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we all of us are a bundle of contradictions. Mm-hmm. And again, I think this is a blessing of the Enneagram, is it helps begin to help you at least at one level begin to go, oh, there's the source of the contradiction.
Yes.
You know, and why I've never really understood these two things in my own life, right?
Yeah.
That seem mutually contradictory, right? So I just a couple of things came to my mind as you were talking. I'm laughing about the Bill Clinton thing because a lot of people will say he's a 3 and I am absolutely convinced he's a 9.
Interesting.
Absolutely convinced. And I know other teachers who are too. It's just so funny to me that even I have no idea if it has anything to do with it, but you know, maybe you felt some degree of simpatico, you know.
I may have. I remember feeling that way.
Wow.
I mean,
I felt a spiritual resonance with him and I couldn't figure out why at the time. That's for sure.
So let's talk a little bit too about deconstruction. And so for folks who are listening, what we're really talking about here is, you know, beginning to interrogate our spiritual identity, convictions, theology, if that's a word for us. I mean, you know, it's actually the ability to step back from what we've been doing our whole life or for a long time and beginning to challenge or allow challenges to come to the fore without anxiety or with anxiety, but still
or with it. Yeah. But allowing,
but able to endure it. And then, so one of the ways I would maybe frame it out is all of us start with a thesis in life, right? And so think about, you know, Christianity as a thesis. And then in deconstruction, what happens is you move to antithesis, right? Or anti-thesis, right? Mm-hmm. And you can become very hostile toward the world from which you came. And then I think where maybe the journey of deconstruction comes to a healthy conclusion, because I see a lot of people who just spend all their lives in antithesis, and it's so unhealthy. They just become bitter, angry, whiners, complainers for the rest of their life about the world they came out of without ever moving on to the place of what I would call synthesis.
I love that.
And so I think I've done it. And I think everybody who's healthy does it many times in their life.
Many times. Absolutely. And not just as a process. Yeah.
And not just in the spiritual life, but in the relationship life, in my marriage, in my friendships, in everything. I begin with a thesis. At some point, I go to antithesis, and then I move towards synthesis.
I love that so much. It's very 9.
It is very 9. And it's, it's very 4.
Yeah, I could see that too.
It's very, very 4 as well. All right, so let me just ask you a couple of questions more. I know that you're a coach now, and that's sort of a new thing that you're doing. Glad you're doing it. Have you used the Enneagram in your coaching?
I have not. I have actually yet to launch the one-to-one portion of it, so it's starting in January. Like most things in my life, what I do is chew the cud for an impossibly long stretch of time, and then I get the ping or the gut feeling or the alignment with the higher self, and I know it's time to do it, and I just go. And so this is similar, you know, I've been tossing around just like idea after idea in my mind. Part of that is my temperament, perhaps the Enneagram, just examining, like circling. And I also live with OCD, and the type of OCD I live with involves excessive ideation. So it's just like, and then one day I just know, and I'm in my body and I know. And so the other day, I was like a few weeks ago, a month ago, it was like the name came, it's the name of my book, Doubt Becomes Wonder. And I was like, that's the coaching practice, is how to midwife people through the transition of losing, whether intentionally or unintentionally, the foundation or the structures of their belief system, and ideally midwifing them to synthesis, because I think community plays a huge role in that. When we swing, which we're inevitably going to do, one thing that can be a medicine in that process is people accepting, loving, encouraging, challenging, coming around us to contextualize our story. And so that became my desire. It was like, I'd like to create a spiritual community that lives online, because we're in COVID 2020, right? But that also involves this one-to-one coaching practice. One-to-one, my favorite thing.
It is. I was about to laugh about that. One-to-one. Being a one-to-one-nine, yeah, that's going to work.
One-to-one, like my dream. Yeah, and I want to, because a midwife or a doula is a person who is ultimately really just there to remind you what your body already knows how to do. And to remind you that you have what it takes, even when it feels like you don't, and that everything about the process is sacred and important and a piece of the whole. And so to me, that's kind of the visual image I have for my coaching practice, is midwifing people through the transition into the birth and through into, like, hopefully a happy, healthy place of wholeness in this one department. And I don't think I can do that for people. I think people can do that for themselves. And I'm just there to remind them that they can, you know, and maybe help them discover the ways, the how of it for themselves based on their temperament and their situation. So that's kind of what I launched.
Yeah. You know, it's really great because nines, integrated nines, make really great therapists, really great coaches, really great spiritual directors. They can really, they know how to come alongside people because they, and they're okay living in that gray zone with people. They, when they're healthy, they manifest what, you know, I learned in grad school is a non-anxious presence. You know, they can be with somebody in pain with and be without anxiety with them, right? And so, yeah, they become the anchor for that person because you radiate peace, you know, and that makes a person feel like, you know, without your needing to say it, you know, it's going to be all right. You know, all shall be well, all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well, which is a great mantra for nines. You know, that's a
it
gift.
Is. Julian of Norwich, Norwich, or however you say it. I often have an image in my mind, and I actually have to do a fair amount of energetic work on myself because I do merge, but I do merge in a non-anxious way nowadays more than an anxious way. And what I envision when I'm with someone, because I do some like, I don't know what you would call it. I don't have any training, but for friends, I, you know, do like massage with energy reading. I just have certain intuitive abilities in that department and have sat with people who are struggling and suffering. And I'll envision myself like a sieve, like I'm hovering above them here and slightly interacting with their border, but I have holes so I can let it flow out through me versus like sitting in my own, like, I don't want to absorb it and take it on. I think transference is a real thing, both psychologically and spiritually. And so I try to envision myself as like I'm floating in the ocean, but I'm full of holes. So like, it's all just kind of flowing out through and leaving and being transmuted into love, hopefully, and healing. But yeah, I do love to sit with people in all kinds of states.
You're in the right gig then. I think that for nines, it's really a natural space. But I think for sure they have to be have done the work of individuation. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they're gonna merge with yeah. with that other person in a really.
And I have done that. I have done that, and it is painful. It is painful stuff. So, I mean, I'm sure that I'll always live with a certain degree of predilection toward that, but I do feel like I'm relatively aware of the tendency, which is all it really takes is consciousness, you know, you can stop and pause and get a look at yourself and readjust.
That's what I was going to ask, Audrey, for our, you know, 9 listeners. What are a few tips for you that have tell you, oh, I'm merging or I have merged?
Yeah. That's a good question. Well, you know, I think there's a lot floating around out there, let's say just on Instagram in particular, in the pop psychology world, about Enneagram, about empathy and empathic people, about narcissism and all these different kinds of, they've become almost buzzwords, like these big ideas that are often really misunderstood by the simplicity with which they're presented. And one thing I think that gets talked about a lot is empathy. Understandably, we all need that. It's a skill and a gift that a lot of people struggle to embody or receive in their lives. And I totally, you know, like believe in empathy and I believe in empathizing. But what you said earlier was that like, sometimes a virtue gets made out of enmeshment and gets called empathy. I feel your feelings with you can be actually a really like not great place to be sitting to the degree that it goes. Cause I have definitely been sort of taken down almost by people who are, they're not intending, you know, to take me down with them. I'm the one being taken down with, right? So like, I'm the one who's sort of like, I'm not anchoring. I'm a barnacle and I'm going down, you know, like on the submarine. And it's like, that is within my control. And so the only tip I can give is an annoying one because it's comprehensive and a large amount of work, but is shadow work, is seeking out a daily practice or 2 or 10 of how to like discover the sort of, fragments in my own psyche and accept them and integrate them and start to become conscious. I don't think I have 10 practical steps. That would be way too one for me. I'm like, you gotta find your own path. But I think what I can say is that I do try to be really conscious of noticing if I'm feeling the empathy or the feeling of someone else's feelings transforming into cortisol in my system. And I can notice that through heart rate elevation. I can notice that through a sense of like tightness in my chest and in my throat, bodily somatic experiences of stress. If I'm starting to exhibit that in an interaction, I've learned to recuse myself or excuse myself for a moment to collect and go like, where are my boundaries dissolving?
That's good.
I often find visualization really helpful as well. And so maybe this is because I'm a body type. I do sort of, when I'm feeling that feeling in an interaction or confrontation, let's say, I start to really imagine my skin becoming a little thicker, like envisioning a border around myself because that is where I struggle, right? To like feel like I have a border or a boundary or a self. And I try to like, have you ever seen the show Alex Mack from the 90s?
No.
So there was this show with, her name was Alyssa. Oh gosh, I can't remember. Or Larissa. She was from 10 Things I Hate About You. Larissa somebody. Anyways, she had this ability to melt into this kind of silver puddle and like go under things and come back into a body. And so I actually always was like, I feel that way. I feel like I can melt myself into like, I just amorphous blob, you know, and there, I just try to envision myself being like in my body and embodied and with borders and boundaries. And sometimes when I feel like I'm merging, visualizing the physical change is really helpful to me. So those are some things that I do.
That's good. But,
it is good. It is really good. And we should do a show on somatic work because when I'm teaching workshops, one of the things I do is encourage people to do somatic work. Where does your passion live in your body? How do you know when envy or sloth or lust is beginning to take the wheel? And you know, for me, I know exactly where envy lives in my body. It's right here in my at the base of my neck and the nape of my neck. And I know that when I feel my throat constricting and I feel this kind of weight around this place of my body, it's like that is a red flag for me. Mm-hmm. And it's like I just start to pay attention to it. And I bring my attention to it and begin to say, what's happening right now?
Yeah. What are you trying to tell me?
What are you trying to tell me? And so that's really great. And I want to remind people that, you know, shadow work, I'm going to have to give this in a very short, simplistic sentence or two, but shadow work, you know, Carl Jung would say that all of us have a shadow, and the shadow is the place that we unconsciously put parts of ourselves, of who we are, out of view. Because we don't want to own it. In fact, sometimes we want to disavow it. We don't. Right. It's inconsistent with our self-image, or it's a piece of who we are that we had to give up in childhood because it wasn't compatible with our culture, what our culture or our family of origin wanted from us, right? And it's also where a lot of those, there are things that belong in the shadow, right? And should stay there, like our animal murderous instinct, perhaps, you know, it's like that has to be acknowledged as being in the shadow. However, we should want it to be mannered. Yeah, I mean, we don't want to indulge that, but we do want to, and by the way, the Enneagram is shadow work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people don't want to hear that. They want StrengthsFinder. Mm-hmm. And you know, what the Enneagram, and people oftentimes say to me, gosh, this thing just feels so negative in the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, you're darn right.
Yeah.
I don't make any apologies for it. It's like,
when it's used properly.
When it's used properly, the Enneagram isn't, oh, I'm a six, and this is what this is. What this is, it's like,
no.
You have only begun. You know, it's like, yes. You know, as a two, you need to realize that it's not that you're just loving or, you know, a little codependent sometimes. It's like, nope, you're calculating and manipulative. Mm-hmm. You use flattery as a way of drawing, of seducing people into the web of your world. And you want to create people who are dependent on you. And you know what I mean? It's like, this is material in the shadow.
Yes.
Right. You know, for a nine, part of the shadow work would be recognizing that you're being nice, quote unquote, or kind of being easygoing or don't rock the boat, blah, 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 is a selfish deal.
Yeah.
You know, because you actually don't want life to get to you. And so you have to do the shadow work of realizing that just being nice is a way of actually abdicating the throne of your own personal authority.
Yep. And it's also keeping people very much at bay, even though we want, you know, there's the merging thing, but it's almost like, I want to connect with you by this weird, like sideways, like, you know, energetically merging with you while not really reckoning with the things you're telling me.
Without having to show up to myself. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And in fact, I'm going to steal your identity.
Yeah.
Mm.
Right.
In order to,
it's vampiric. Yeah.
Yeah.
It very much. That's a great word.
It is.
Now, nines, you're uncomfortable right now because you always will be when you do shadow work.
Yeah. That's the part. That's where, you know, it's working.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Ow. And this is another Jungian idea. Very important is the golden shadow. So there are parts of your shadow that where you have, for reasons of survival, maintaining relationships with important people in your life. You know, for example, you might have been a child who was very, very creative, very musical. But what if the message from your family was, you know, oh, music?
oh, that's, you know, lower passions. And, you know, if you were a real Christian, you know, be very careful of the creative, imaginative world. You're a sinful person.
Show business
is a bad thing. and so, you know, you had to relegate that into the golden shadow. And so part of the journey of doing shadow work isn't just the negative thing. It's also bringing back all the beautiful pieces of you that were lost and forgotten as a little person. I got to finish up. I want you to tell everybody what you're doing and where they can find out about it.
Okay. Well, I'm working on a book called Doubt Becomes Wonder, which comes out in October with Penguin Random House. And I'm on the Convergent imprint, which I'm super pumped about because I love everything they publish. So I'm like, can't believe I get to be part of this group. It's been the single biggest honor of my life so far. And it's a book about, you know, transmuting what is often sort of maligned as a negative thing in religious culture, which is doubt, into its what I think the potential of it is, which is a wonder. It's the curiosity, playful spirituality, how to be a spiritual person in the wake of the loss of belief. Because a lot of people don't know what they believe and may never know, and yet they want to experience the world spiritually. So how do you do that? So that's what I'm writing about. And it's a lot of my own story and the things I have learned. And then I am also launching this community called Doubt Becomes Wonder, which will involve several tiers of engagement, you know, from group to one-to-one coaching options. I'll be launching the website for that in the new year, which I imagine is when this will be airing anyway. And the other thing is that I have a podcast called Archetypical with a Jungian analyst named Tony Caldwell, in which we explore ourselves through the archetypal figures and themes in pop culture and story and religion. So our first two episodes were about Christ, our second two are about Antichrist, and then we are moving on to everything from Medusa to Bob Dylan to androgynous pop culture figures. Just everything and anything that kind of lends us an opportunity to gain a perspective on ourselves via these pieces of story that archetypes provide. So that's what I'm up to. And then I also make music for a living. So you can find me on Spotify and Apple Music and all the places.
And I assume that people can go to your website, which is assuming is audreyassad.com.
It is.
And learn about all these things that you're doing. And just to be, because I have to do this with my name, that's AudreyAssad.com. Yes. Yes. And it's the curse of not being Bill Smith.com. You know, just that people can go there and learn all about this stuff. I can't commend your music highly enough to people.
Thank you.
And I feel so good. You're my Christmas present.
Oh, thanks, Ian.
This year.
It's so good to see you.
I know. And it was so good to see you. And peace on earth to you and to all the people that you love. Anthony?
Let's do it.
May you have love. May you have joy.
May you have peace, may you have healing,
and may you have rest. Until next time.